Wake up call!
This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Hour three, we're rolling along this morning. Glad you can be with us as we continue along looking at, of course, the NFL playoff weekend, the championship game. That's going to lead us to an incredible 2 weeks of Super Bowl hype. Get it every single year. We're going to get it again this year. Nui Scruggs is going to join us, KXAS-TV, Channel 5 in Dallas. He's going to come up at 30 past the hour. We're going to talk about the Cowboys and where they're going from here as we continue to look at the teams that lost this weekend and their future. The Dallas Cowboys are, as we've been saying this week, target, target, target. Whether it's Dak Prescott and what kind of level quarterback he is, Mike McCarthy, whether he's good enough to be a head coach, they get the biggest, biggest sort of target on their back because of the Cowboys, and they draw a lot of eyeballs whenever they make news, and there's always a lot of interest, and people always have an opinion about them. You can go to any place in America, go to any bar in America, ask about the Dallas Cowboys, and you're going to get a response. People seem to know about this team, even if it's nowhere near them, even if they're not in the fan base. You know, I live in Nashville with the Tennessee Titans. Try to find a sports bar that's buzzing about the Titans. Like, does anybody in New England know that Rand Carthon is the new general manager, right? I mean, in fact, it was funny. It was like I had a friend of mine, and he asked me point blank. He goes, "Did you guys talk about Rand Carthon this week?" And I go, "No." He goes, "Oh, well," and he was like surprised. And I'm like, "Well, I don't do a local Nashville show. I do a national show. So I mean, if I was locally in Nashville, I would have been all over Rand Carthon and his qualifications and the obstacles and whatnot." I said, but, I mean, how many people really care who the general manager of the Tennessee Titans is? But imagine if there was a big shakeup with the Cowboys. Imagine if there was a big, huge sort of power dynamic shift with the Cowboys. I could go anywhere. I could go anywhere in America. And somebody would have an opinion on the Dallas Cowboys. That's it. And very few teams in the American sports landscape carry that kind of weight. I mean, the Yankees do. I guess you could say the Lakers do. Right? But very, very few organizations where there's anything that goes along can be really broken down and make the kind of news and the kind of headlines. You know, remember a couple of years ago, Ron? It's probably not a couple, but remember when Magic Johnson just resigned, right, from the Lakers? Yeah. Remember that?
That was awesome.
Of course it's Magic Johnson and it's the Lakers, right? As mentioned. But imagine if you had the Memphis Grizzlies. Let's say you had a star Memphis Grizzly from back in the day that was running the front office and abruptly quit. How many people would be buzzing about it? Right? I know it's Magic Johnson, he's one of the best players in the world, but you know, he's considered one of the greatest NBA players of all time. But that just the purple and goldness of the Lakers and their history transcends a lot of teams, and they just, the Dallas Cowboys. I saw a topic this morning on one of these debate shows. Does Jerry Jones need another Super Bowl to cement his legacy? What, 3 and 4 years isn't enough? You have to have another one 30 years later?
Yeah, you want to know what his legacy is? Go to a casual football fan, maybe not someone who's not a football fan.
Right.
They probably know who Jerry Jones is.
Exactly. Exactly. Like,
you know, tell me who owns the Minnesota Vikings.
Great point. Great point. Was it Ziggy Wilf?
I think.
I was just
Ziggy
thinking.
Sounds familiar.
But that's
where we're at, right?
Do you realize what we're doing with this organization that we just don't do with anybody else? Pat Bowlen passed away a couple years ago. I covered the Broncos for 10 years. I think Pat Bowlen is one of the greatest owners the NFL's ever had. He's just salt of the earth guy. He rarely spoke, but when he did, it was powerful. Two Super Bowls. He owned the team. They won two Super Bowls. But he also owned the team with Dan Reeves and messy situation with Elway. And they brought in Tommy Maddox. But you know what? Nobody looked at Pat Bowlen and went, well, two Super Bowls, but he lost those three. What's his legacy? Everybody went, this guy is a great legacy. If you can't say that Jerry Jones doesn't have a good legacy in the NFL, you haven't been paying attention. Right? Jerry Jones may be combative. Jerry Jones may be full of himself. Jerry Jones may love the media spotlight, but none of that matters when you talk about legacy. People have legacy for good things. They have legacy for bad things. Jerry Jones may not be the strong, silent type. He loves a microphone. He loves his radio hits. He loves speaking to people about a team. Sometimes he speaks what's on his mind. Sometimes he's a little reserved, but you can kind of tell what's on his mind. He kind of leaves it out there. But go to every single new stadium in America for the NFL. Go to these brand new facilities. They all came because Jerry Jones built his. Right? Now, again, some of it's good because we've got these brand new state-of-the-art facilities. Some of that's not so good because some of those facilities, not his, but some of those facilities were built with a lot of taxpayer money, and most people don't like that. But that's what Jerry Jones, can do. Dan Snyder has a poor legacy because Dan Snyder didn't win. Let's be flat honest about this, okay? Because I know there's a lot of scandal that's going on. There's a lot of things in the front office that's not good. But can we be honest here? Do you think the average Redskins fan, or I'm sorry, Commanders fan, cares about that enough that Dan Snyder has to sell the team? If you went to a Commanders fan and said, "Why should Dan Snyder sell the team?" What do you think the number one answer is going to be? They don't win. They're not competitive. Sexual harassment scandal? Yeah, that's bad, but they don't win. Workplace culture? Terrible? Yeah, but they don't win. Moving money from a Kenny Chesney concert into his own pocket when he was supposed to share? No, they don't win. Every scandal that Dan Snyder has, every one of them, the real reason people can't wait for Washington to sell the franchise, for him to sell the franchise, is because they believe on the other end of it, it's not going to be a better workplace environment, and they're going to divide the Kenny Chesney tickets properly, and he's not going to siphon money from other things. They think it's because that means somebody will come in and they will start winning. Jerry Jones and the Dallas Cowboys haven't been in a Super Bowl since they beat the Steelers in Super Bowl 30. But you know what? He won 3 of 4. And just because he hasn't won it recently, it doesn't mean he has a bad legacy. Now, full disclosure, I actually like Jerry Jones. I've said it many times on this show. I like Jerry Jones. I just like him as a guy that is good for me and my business because he talks all the time. He's good for me and my business in that he loves his team so much that you kind of think he would do anything and everything. But I've always said this about Jerry Jones, and I said it many years when we were doing mornings together, so I'm going to say it now that we've been in this new time slot. When you are a fan of a team, you want your owner to love the team like you love the team. You don't want an owner that just owns it, doesn't do anything with it, lets other people run it, treats it as just a commodity, just a thing in the portfolio. I'll show up some games, I'll say hi, I'll wave, but I got a shipping business over here and a tech business over there, and this is just one of the things I own. Jones is all in. This is the thing he loves. This is the thing he cares about. And win or lose, every Cowboy fan in America knows that their owner is as into the success of the team as they are. He's not using it. He's not trying to pinch pennies. He's not trying to, you know, oh, well, you know, it's okay if we win, lose, whatever, as long as the profits are there to give to the shareholders. There's no shareholders. He owns it all. And I've always said the one thing about him that I've always appreciated, when he built that stadium and that facility, practice facility, have you ever done one of those virtual tours where they go like, here's all the awesomeness of the practice facility. Forget the stadium, just the offices and where they go to work out and get treated and all that stuff. The whole complex, the star. He looked at his team and he said, you know what? My team deserves the best. They deserve the best of the best. Because my fan base, they wouldn't accept anything less. They have been accustomed their whole lives to being told that the team they root for is America's team. My brother is a Cowboys fan. And as a Steeler fan, we kind of grew up in the 70s. We kind of picked two winning teams because the Patriots weren't that good. But we picked two winning teams. My brother talks about this all the time. He talks about it all the time. He still talks about it 40-something years later where he says, we're America's team. America's team. And Jerry Jones realized that, And he never wavered from that. He never said, no, 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 we're not. We're a business. And when we're a business, we have to make tough decisions. And it's my money. He went, no, you're right. You are America's team. And I'm going to treat this like America's team. So when we build a stadium, and when they built it, it was the best thing in the world. When we built the practice facility, no other practice facility is going to be better than this. We do it bigger and better here because we're the Dallas Cowboys. That is Jerry Jones's philosophy. Again, roll your eyes at it. I get it. But that's the reality. Now, I, as a Steeler fan, grew up despising the Cowboys. It's just the natural rivalry, right? But I've been able to pull myself away to go, when I see that, I respect it. I don't always agree with Jerry Jones' decision. When I say I like Jerry Jones, I don't go, well, you like this guy and I like this guy, or he drafted this guy and I think it's awesome. That's not what I mean when I like him, when I say I like him. I just like what he is, warts and all. The pain on his face, the grimace in the box, the clenched teeth in the press conference afterwards, or what do you call it, a press conference, when they all gather around him when he's walking out of the suite down into the tunnel. A guy that goes on the radio to share what he's thinking when other owners, you don't even know who they are half the time. He's willing to say, I'm all in. Here's the chips. Love it. Hate us. Love us. I don't care. I'm all in. And where people are saying, what's his legacy going to be like if he doesn't win a Super Bowl? It's because for the last 30 years, 25 years or 26 years, whatever it's been, he has put all of his chips in all the time. And you go, man, it's got to pay off sometime, right? And it's just not paying off. That's Jerry Jones. And so it is fascinating to watch the media come up with all different angles to describe their woes.
This is Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, coming up in 15 minutes, we'll talk Dallas Cowboys again with Nui Scruggs. Again, Channel 5 in Dallas. And then we'll do some Super Bowl history on this date, a couple of Super Bowls to remember. Again, congratulations to Scott Rowland, who has voted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. So I get this every single year, so it's worth revisiting. Is the voting process for the Baseball Hall of Fame, does it need to change? So here's what I mean. So as I said earlier in the show, if you don't know the process, it's very simple. Most of you know it, but I'll give a refresher course. You get a list of candidates. You're a voter. You can choose up to 10. You don't have to choose 10. You can choose 5. You can choose 3, choose 1. What you can do, 0. But you can only choose up to 10. So you get a list, you pick 10, and then you turn it in. If that individual gets 75% of the votes to the 400-plus members that are part of this, you get to be in the Hall of Fame. Now, it may not sound like that sounds like a fair thing, right? You get on the ballot. If 75% of the writers vote you in, then you're in. But here's this is where the controversy is. So depending on who's on the ballot, you may not get enough votes your first year. You may get a lot of votes in year 3, but not quite 75. But then the next year, it's loaded with Hall of Fame players, and you all of a sudden now you're down to 55. Then you go to the next year, and now you might be up to like 72, but you're not quite there. Then you might get 52%. Again, it depends on who's on the ballot. And it makes people go, well, all right, hold on. So what you're telling me is this. A guy plays his Major League Baseball career. In this case, let's talk Scott Rowland, for example. Scott Rowland played 17 seasons. He was Rookie of the Year. He batted .281 career-wise, over 1,200 RBIs, 316 home runs. He was part of the 2006 World Series championship with the Cardinals, right? So he gets on the ballot the first year, and he gets 20-something percent of the vote. Well, now you're telling me he's all Hall of Fame? He didn't do anything. He didn't add to anything. It's not like he was like, oh, hold on one second. I'm going to come back and play one more year just to maybe pump up the stats a little more. What his resume is was it in his first year on the ballot, was his resume yesterday when it was his sixth time on the ballot. So what the writers basically are saying is, based on the competition for the slot, he wasn't good enough then, but he's good enough now based on the absence of some other players. Does that make it a Hall of Fame worthy selection? Well, I got a couple things about that. First of all, I can understand it, right? Either the guy is a Hall of Famer or he's not a Hall of Famer. But I do think that in there are certain cases of players that a player's resume needs a little bit of seasoning. It needs sort of a fine wine approach, gets a little better with age. And in certain cases, Derek Jeter, right? Tom Seaver, guys in the, you know, who entered first year right out of the gate, near unanimous selections. Those guys will always get theirs. Always. Always. But the Hall of Fame is also going to be filled with people where you needed to sort of pause and really appreciate it and maybe let it simmer a little bit and decide. And in case of Scott Rolen, yeah, that's the case. I mean, he wasn't a first ballot Hall of Famer. He's a sixth ballot Hall of Famer. But his resume and the fact he was an amazing defensive third baseman, 8 gold gloves. Again, statistically on offense, he never led in any category. But these are legitimate Hall of Fame numbers. But you can almost see where the critics are saying, but it doesn't feel right that the reason he's in the Hall of Fame is that the ballot was absent of 10 other guys that were more worthy than him. And that is true. That is true. Todd Helton, for example. I think Todd Helton should be in the Hall of Fame. Now, it's not because I covered Todd Helton for a number of years, because I thought Todd Helton, even when he was on the road, had really good numbers. You could take the Coors Field altitude numbers out of it, and he still had remarkably good numbers for being on the road at other stadiums and baseball parks where the altitude wasn't a factor. But I always said, look, I think the altitude was always a little overblown. I think Coors Field is technically a little larger, and yeah, it really helps. But I never thought it was. I never felt like the stats were incredibly different. There were a couple of guys that we could point to and say, man, at home they were unbelievable. But Todd Helton on the road was a fine, but he didn't get in this time. Next year they're saying he could get in because the field will be a little weaker. Does that sound like something that we should be doing when it comes to Hall of Fame votes? Because I can say, like, if you're either a Hall of Famer or you're not, it shouldn't matter whether, like, why are we voting for 10? If there's 12 people that deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, then put 12 people in the Hall of Fame. We don't have to find just 3 or 4 or 2 or 1 or 0. If you see a ballot and you go, man, there's 14 guys here that should be first ballot Hall of Famers, they're all Hall of Famers. Because everybody gets to be put on the ballot. There's not a committee that says, like, the ballot is filled with names that have no chance of being eligible, right? Like, almost everybody gets put on the ballot. I think there's a little criteria, but it's not controversial, right? I mean, Mike Napoli is going to be on the ballot next year, right? Bronson Arroyo is going to be on the ballot next year. Didn't Bronson Arroyo have a no-hitter? I think he did, but nevertheless. You know who's on the ballot next year? R.A. Dickey. Remember him? The screwball?
Was it screwball or knuckleball?
Knuckleball. I'm sorry, the knuckleball pitcher?
Yeah, I do remember him.
Remember him? Yeah, R.A. Dickey's going to be on the ballot. Jacoby Ellsbury is going to be on the ballot next year. I remember I covered the 2007 World Series, and I got sprayed on. They didn't spray me. They were just spraying in general at Jacoby Ellsbury, and I was standing near Jacoby Ellsbury's locker when somebody came over and sprayed champagne. I should have saved the shirt. I never thought about that. Should I have saved a Red Sox champagne shirt from the World Series?
Yeah.
I never even thought about it. But no, I was in the...
Put it in a glass jar?
Right. Put it in the glass. Yeah, exactly. I was in the locker room. I'm going to give you a little inside baseball. So I was working for a station in Colorado. So I was there for the station I was working for in Colorado. But I was also doing like stringer work. But on that particular night, I didn't need to do the stringer work. We had another guy. We had a couple guys that were all doing it. And so it was a four-game series because the Red Sox swept the Rockies. And so I covered game three. So in game three, I was in doing all my stuff, getting quotes, writing the story, et cetera. But game four, I didn't have to do it. We were sharing the wealth a little bit with the two other guys that covered the season so we all could get a chance to go to the postseason. The one guy that got screwed out, he was supposed to go to game five. There was no game five, so he didn't get to go. But because I had a credential and I was still covering it for the Colorado station that I was working for, I decided to go to game four anyway, right? I wasn't on assignment. But I wasn't on assignment to go into the Red Sox locker room at the end. I just went in to I wanted to get some winners stuff, right? Well, I should have probably been in the Rockies locker room. But I wanted to see the celebration. I wanted to be a part, like see what they were doing. And then what they do is the media stands outside, they have their celebration, and then you go in to do your work. But there's always like residual people still drinking champagne, spraying it, being crazy. But I had no real working business being in there other than, might as well be here. Why not? Might as well go in and see what happens. So, but Jacoby Ellsbury was the guy I was standing next to. Did I ever think like, oh man, Hall of Fame guy? No, he's not going to get in, but he's on the ballot. So, but I think that's a legitimate debate. I don't know how else to do it though. I don't know how else they will do. I just don't know, understand how they will do it in the future. I don't know. What would the process be? Do we want a Hall of Fame ceremony where there's like 10 guys that get into the Hall of Fame?
Yeah. No.
You know what I mean? Like we got, all right.
No, I mean, it's supposed
number
to be
seven on the,
it's supposed to be an extremely hard club to get
right,
into.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And yeah, I mean, sometimes you have one, sometimes you have two, sometimes you have none. You know, I mean, I look back on it when I, you know, looking at, you know, different dates of what happened on this date in history and stuff like that. You find it weird when there's three.
Yeah.
It's like, exactly. there were three good players. And you look at the three and you're like, yeah, those are all no brainers.
And I think the Hall of Fame, and listen, we were talking this about Eli Manning. Was it yesterday or the day before? We were talking about Eli Manning. And I said, look, you know what's great about Eli Manning's career is that there's a legitimate debate. Right, there's like a legitimate debate about his Hall of Fame candidacy. If you were to research it, you'd find really strong cases for his inclusion, and you'd find really strong cases for him not getting in. And they're legitimate. I think he's going to get in, but that's just my personal thought. But if he didn't, I wouldn't say, oh my God, I'm blown away by this. But the Hall of Fame has a bunch of those guys. That's just the way it is. I mean, people go, is it the Hall of the Very Good or is it the Hall of Fame? You know what? In this day and age, with debate, you're going to find guys that some people are going to say are very good. Not everyone is going to be Babe Ruth.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us as we continue hour number three rolling along this morning. And again, if you are new to the show and you want to hit us up with thoughts or whatever, hit us up on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N. Newey Scruggs is set to join us from Channel 5 in Dallas as we continue to look at the teams that are no longer with us in the postseason, because tomorrow and Friday we're really going to focus on the teams that have a chance to win the Vince Lombardi Trophy, Super Bowl 57 in Glendale, Arizona. I'm old enough to be like, wow, we're up to 57 already. I mean, we continue with the Roman numerals or do we just roll with the numbers? I don't know. But because they're getting to a point where it's like, wait, hold on. L is this and then, all right, I got it. But hey, that's how I learned Roman numerals when I was a kid. It didn't help me at all growing up. When I was a kid, that's how I learned it. All right, Newey Scruggs joins us, Channel 5 in Dallas on a Progressive guest line. Progressive for a job you love. Visit progressive.com/careers. How are you, sir?
Good, good. How are you?
Good. Are we being a little hyperbolic in the national media? Are we saying, all right, look, Mike McCarthy's got to go, and Dak Prescott's not capable of winning a Super Bowl, and yikes, Jerry Jones' legacy. There's a lot of hyperbole around the Cowboys because they are such a national and worldwide brand. Are people going crazy, or are these legitimate discussions that they should be having?
They're not legitimate discussions, and honestly, I stopped listening to this kind of stuff because I'm there all the time, so I think that anybody that wants to think about firing Mike McCarthy after two 12-win seasons doesn't realize it hadn't happened since 96. This is not a franchise that's out here winning every year like Kansas City. It's not happened here. Bill Parcells never had back-to-back 10-win seasons. And, you know, Bill Parcells was brought in to really, you know, turn these things around here. And Bill had some playoff seasons. He also had some playoff failures. But to look at not look at everything Mike McCarthy did within the season, you lost your quarterback for five games. You lost your left tackle 2 weeks before the season started here. Your tight end missed games. Your running back missed games. Your safety missed games. I mean, they lost a lot of players, had to play a lot of young guys. And I think the guy did a good job, and to sit up here and even think about firing him is foolish because who you replace him with?
There is a situation with Dak Prescott where I feel like before the game against Tampa Bay, here come the arrows about his legacy, his status, all of that. Then he wins and people said flipped it on a dime again, and then they turned it right back again. There's just this huge up and down with him. How do people in Dallas feel about him? How do you view the way he's played since becoming the legit starter of this team?
Troy Aikman was vilified until he won it all. There are people who said that they should have kept Steve Walsh because he was a winner, and Troy never won anything at UCLA. There are people who said, well, go with Steve Beuerlein. I mean, Jimmy Johnson started Steve Beuerlein the year before the Cowboys ended up winning the Super Bowl in two playoff games. So until you win it all, this is what you get. I look at Eli Manning all the time as a guy that, you know, had people going after him, and until he won it all, you know, he wasn't considered elite. Joe Flacco, yeah. Same thing. You know, you have to win this thing. Otherwise, people are going to continually say, you know, you can't get it done. That's a part of the gig. It's a part of the gig of, you know, being a quarterback for a five-time NFL champion. I mean, Steve Young went through it. Steve Young is, you know, we all know what Steve Young was as a football player before he won a Super Bowl. But that's just what happened when you play for a legendary franchise.
Talking about a 12-5 team that made it to the divisional round of the playoffs, we're really just talking about sort of nooks and crannies. But what was something about this the Dallas season that was a problem, and how do they go about fixing it? What is their big concern this offseason?
Well, I have picked to go 9-8 and win the wild card. So they outperformed what I thought they would. I thought Philadelphia had a better roster, and Howie Roseman went out and put together a good team. The problem from the time we got to training camp was the receiving core. It was CeeDee and the maybes. James Washington was brought in as this. Oh, we could pluck him over here where Amari Cooper is out, and Michael Gallup. Well, he may miss the first few games, but he'll round into shape and be fine. It never happened. Washington was never healthy, never contributed. Michael Gallup never came around at all. I mean, he had zero catches in the playoff game. They're out here trying to beg Odell Beckham Jr. to come play for him, so they end up with T.Y. Hilton, who had one catch in the playoff game. Then you got Noah Brown, a guy who was your five, your number five receiver a year ago, out here, you know, making significant, you know, having to play significant minutes on the football field. He had two catches in that game. So Jerry Jones, one more time, they did it before they traded for Amari Cooper, and they cut Dez Bryant, tried to throw together, slap together a receiving corps, and it failed. You cannot sit up here and give just one player. By the way, CeeDee Lamb struggled the first month of the season before he came around to become a Pro Bowl player. You can't give a guy like Dak Prescott subpar weapons. Dak Prescott needs better weapons around him, and they failed him. And against Tampa, you got by with it. Against San Francisco, it didn't work.
Yeah. From the Tony Pollard standpoint, how much of an impact was that injury to the game, and where did you see where he could have been helpful towards the end?
He was you had two playmakers, you know, two difference makers out there. It was Pollard and Lamb, so you took a difference maker away. That hurt their football team.
Nui, we've been talking about the Cowboys in this, and you said it earlier, like there's just so much around this team, and a lot of it involves around Jerry Jones. What is he like on a day-to-day basis to cover? Like, a guy like me lives in Nashville. I follow the cool stuff, the stuff that makes news, the stuff that's interesting. But there's a lot of daily stuff that he does. What is it like to cover this guy? What is it like when he, as the owner of this team, that seems to, just on the outside looking in, he puts everything into this?
You know, he doesn't deal with this daily. So that's, you know, so that, take that part. It's you know, usually every other week or so when we get to Jerry, usually it's going to be after games. Look, there's one constant in the fact that they haven't won anything since 1996, and that's Jerry Jones. When you come and work for Jerry Jones, you know, coaches know that, you know, Jerry's going to get on his radio show. He'll give away information. He'll telegraph stuff, and it's frustrating for people. I think it took Mike McCarthy in a year or two to figure out, okay, I got to put a bubble around this team. Hey, guys, don't pay attention to what Jerry Jones is saying. Same thing that Joe Torre did when he worked for George Steinbrenner. Oh, by the way, George Steinbrenner and Jerry Jones were very good friends. We even opened up a business together that still exists today. So Jerry is there doing Jerry things. Jerry cares about, you know, the marketing. He cares about publicity. Yeah, Jerry cares about the style. And sometimes, in my opinion, cares more style than substance, which is why you see, I think it's 26 teams since the Cowboys have last won a Super Bowl, 26 different teams have played an NFC Championship game except the Cowboys. So Jerry is the person that you should point the finger at here about why things are the way they are, such as I'm mad at Amari Cooper, and I'm going to get rid of Amari Cooper for a fifth-round pick, and I'm going to replace it with some dude that I hope and think will do something, and they didn't.
Would it be better if he was more of the strong, silent owner type that we see around the league? Does this hurt him in any ways?
Uh-huh. What would happen? I used to do Jerry Jones' radio show when I worked at the flagship station. So every Friday at 10 o'clock, I had these discussions with Jerry.
Yeah.
And Jerry's like, you know what? If you put a general manager, you know what you do? All you do is put a middleman, because he's still going to have to come to me because I'm still going to make these decisions. So, right. Oh, well. You know, he's going to be like Al Davis. He's going to do it his way. And while we can all point and say, look, Jerry, the failings are here, Jerry sits up here and tells us, well, I got to look at the man in the mirror, and I got to make those decisions. I got to get better. So it is what it is.
Yeah, I was in Denver for 10 years, and Pat Bowlen is so highly regarded. But when Pat Bowlen spoke, you knew it was important, but he didn't speak a lot. Are people getting a little tired of the act, or do they appreciate at least the openness of an owner that says, I'm going to tell you what's on my mind all the time, no matter what?
The stadium's still full.
Yeah,
people still buying drinks.
That's right.
You go to San Francisco, man. You know, it's a whole truckload of Cowboy fans out there. So, you know, people vote with their pocketbook. And Jerry's got the richest franchise in the game.
That's right. This offseason, you mentioned wide receiver. How do they look cap-wise? How do they look being able to go after some players? And what decisions are they going to have to make this offseason?
Obviously, you got to upgrade your receiving core. You got to be able to stop the run. They don't stop the run well enough, so they've got to fix the interior defensive line. They've got a couple questions here. They lost their starting outside corner, Anthony Brown, to injury. He's a free agent. Then you lost your starting slot corner, Jordan Lewis. He's still under contract. So what do you do with Brown? Most likely, I think they go with De'Ron Bland and they try to go find a free agent or a rookie. But you know, they got some issues there. They've been linebacker Leighton Vander Esch. What are they going to do with him? He did have a good season. If Dan Quinn gets a head coaching job like I expect, then some of these good Cowboy free agents and coaches will end up going with Dan. So there's a lot of fluctuations going on here to see what happens with this team. Kellen Moore up for the Carolina Panthers job. He could conceivably get it. So we'll see how they have to hit a reset.
You were just reading my mind. That was my next pot. These two coordinators, they're both kind of hot, especially Dan Quinn. And how much are we watching those stories? Which one is more likely to stay? Could they both leave?
Look, Kellen Moore fits the description of what they hire in the NFL right now. Young, white, offensive mind. Those guys are getting jobs. Who call plays. Dan Quinn is, I think anybody who's smart will be wise to go get Dan Quinn. You talk to the offensive players, and they'll tell you how much they love Dan Quinn and what he has done with this Cowboys defense. The guy's really, really good at what he does. He has been to a Super Bowl, and I would be eager to hire somebody who has unfinished business like Dan Quinn. Denver should have did it last year. They were foolish not to do it, but oh well. Let's see if they do it this time around.
Nui, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. Good conversation. Thank you so much.
All right, call anytime. Be well. Have
you
a great day.
You got it. News Krugs, Channel 5 in Dallas. Good stuff on the Cowboys. And not as high as Jerry Jones, but again, since 1996, January of 96, when they beat the Steelers in Super Bowl 30, and everything that has transpired since. All right, Super Bowl history when we come back, because it's that time of year and that time of the show where we go over some of the better Super Bowls and the not-so-good Super Bowls, but they all happened on this date. We'll continue. It is Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.
This is Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks to Nui Scruggs, Channel 5 in Dallas. Robert on Twitter said, I sense you will enjoy at Nui Scruggs. He had a national radio show a few years back. Yeah, he was good. I liked him. I liked his analysis. I may rethink a little bit about my love with Jerry Jones. Yeah, well, what do you? I mean, I don't expect Jerry. Jerry Jones was never the guy that was like, all right, I'll let football people talk football. I don't know anything about football. He played football, played at Arkansas. But you know what's funny? We talk about all these. Yeah, you should never hire a college coach ever. Jimmy Johnson worked out. That worked out good.
Yeah, it did. Barry Switzer.
And Barry Switzer worked out. Yeah, just that one Super Bowl. But nevertheless, Jerry Jones had to put up with that 1-15 season. Then got the right team around him. Then a little 2 out of 3 years. But yeah, I mean, look, there's certain people that get successful because they find the right people to help them be successful, or they find the right people to help as they're going to be making decisions, but they need smart people around them. Jerry Jones thinks he's smarter than the most guys in the room. And he's probably right in terms of like his team. Like, you're not going to override, but I mean, if you're a general manager, would you work for Jerry Jones? If you're a smart GM, probably not. Cause he's right. Like, you don't just get to do it. Right?
You're not doing it by yourself.
Yeah, you're not doing it by yourself. You're not going to be able to go, look, I've been training for this. I've been practicing this. You're going to go in there and go, ah, I got to convince Jerry of everything. That's just kind of the way it is.
Or it's that, you know, you walk in and there's already a few post-its on your door saying, hey, have you thought about this guy? What about this guy? I've already reached out to him. He's coming in tomorrow.
That's right. All right, so this date in Super Bowl history is a segment we do all the way through the Super Bowl season. And today, January 25th. And there's a couple of Super Bowls to chat about. 1981 was Super Bowl 15. It was in New Orleans. It featured Oakland against Philadelphia. And the Eagles are one game away from going back to the Super Bowl. Ron Jaworski and the Eagles against Jim Plunkett and the Raiders. Now, one of the things about this Super Bowl was that they put a yellow ribbon on the Superdome, because if you were alive at that time or remember that time, that's when the hostages were released, the Iran hostage crisis that was on the news every single day for over a year. And then Reagan got inaugurated and they were released, and they had these yellow ribbons that people would put till the hostages came home. And they did that in that Super Bowl. But the Raiders went on to win that Super Bowl. Tom Flores was the head coach. Then the next one that happened on the 25th was, at least in our family, one of the should be a holiday in our family, by the way, was the Super Bowl 21, and it was featuring the New York Giants in their first ever Super Bowl, taking on John Elway and the Denver Broncos. This is the game. This game is significant on a couple of levels. It's significant because, one, it was the first world championship, Super Bowl championship for the New York Giants. They've been around a long, long time, but this was their first Super Bowl title. They beat John Elway, and this was Elway's first appearance in the Super Bowl. And it had one of those, oh, that's okay, he'll get his. He didn't get his till later. Like, he didn't get his till his mid-30s. But this was part of the Broncos losing 3 of the next 4 Super Bowls and a story in every one of them. And the story of this one was Phil Simms, who threw a near-perfect quarterback game. Very few incompletions, and was nearly perfect throwing the football. The Giants had Mark Bavaro, they had Phil McConkey, but they had a defense, a smothering, smothering defense. Phil McConkey was the towel-waving New York Giant. But, Phil Simms is known for one thing in this game. Do you know what that is?
No,
there's,
I don't
remember. One thing.
No.
One thing he did that ended up having a legacy in the Super Bowl, and that he was the first quarterback to look at the camera and say, I'm going to Disneyland.
That's right.
Or Disney World. I can't remember which one he chose. I would assume they were in Pasadena, so I think he would say Disneyland. But he was the first one. They offered him the money. They offered both quarterbacks the money. They said, whoever wins, we just need you at some point on the field to turn to the camera and say this. Both agreed to do it. Phil Simms almost forgot it until he had to be reminded of it while he was in complete euphoria and celebration, and it's still something they do to this day. So Phil Simms was the first one to do the Disney World, Disneyland pitch at the end of the Super Bowl. And then, they created that When You Wish Upon a Star thing. And Phil Simms, you and the Giants are Super Bowl champions.
And then you have the MVP and maybe another player or two to be named later at Disneyland or Disney World the following day.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. then Super Bowl, what was the other one? The Denver Broncos.
Yeah.
This Denver Broncos won. So they lost to the Giants, and then they won this one in San Diego. This is, again, I got to Denver 2 years after they had won the Super Bowl. So the last Super Bowl, when they beat the Falcons. No, I'm sorry. I came in a year after that. And I heard all the stories when I got there about what it was like for that city to finally win the Super Bowl. Oh, my God. I could write books. Every story. I mean, they treated it like the Red Sox when the Red Sox won the World Series. Like, just longing for the days where you could win a Super Bowl. Well, they had lost four. They lost three with Elway, and they lost one with Craig Morton at quarterback when they fell to Dallas in Super Bowl 12. In this particular Super Bowl, they were heavy, heavy underdogs. The Packers had just come off a Super Bowl victory against the New England Patriots the year before. They were going to San Diego. They were a wild card team that year, en route to winning. They had to beat the Steelers in Three Rivers Stadium in order to get to the Super Bowl. They had beaten Kansas City in Kansas City to get to the game against the Steelers. So they weren't Denver like John Elway's dominating the league Denver. That came a year later. But this Super Bowl was where, do you remember at the end, where the Packers had a choice at the end of the game? We have Brett Favre, we can score, and do we let Terrell Davis run in for a touchdown? And that still puts us in striking distance of being able to get back into this game with time on the clock, or do we try to make a goal line stance and just let the clock run and run and run? The Broncos won by 7 points. They knew they had to get Brett Favre on the field, and they did, and they couldn't win the game. And it was, I think it was one of the, at the time, there were some big upsets in the Super Bowl, but this was a big upset. This was, the Packers were favored by double digits in this game.
And it probably gave us one of the more known highlights.
Yeah, the helicopter.
The helicopter.
Yeah. That really became sort of the calling card of old athletes. Because Elway was like 35 at the time, I think. I
mean, so old.
30, right? So old. Yeah, right. I know. And it was just it just became the epitome of an athlete. Like, I'm going to give my whole body to this. Like I don't know if I'm ever going to get here again. I have no idea if I'm going to get another chance at this. But while I'm here, I'll die on this field if I have to. But we're going to win this Super Bowl. And that was when Pat Bowlen, they hoisted the trophy. And they said, this one's for John. And then the next year, they said, this one's for Pat. He knew what the struggles of John Elway. Because you know what? No matter how good of a career you have in this league, no matter how many things you do and records and throwing and passing touchdowns and all those things you have, when you are leaving this league and the thing people remember is, didn't you get blown out in 3 Super Bowls in 4 years? It's really tough. Think about all the things Jim Kelly did in his career with the Bills. Did anybody care? Nope. 4 Super Bowls, 4 losses. And that was Elway. Elway was Jim Kelly before Jim Kelly, and they were all, what, Fran Tarkenton before Fran Tarkenton? But it was, everyone, they were all Fran Tarkenton. Well, Fran Tarkenton had lost for him. That's where the Vikings were. I mean, the Broncos were. Remember the one, I think historians will look on from 1989 to, I think it's still on today. I think when historians want to know about the culture of our society, they will watch every episode of The Simpsons. They will see every trend that we ever went through in the last 3 decades because they'll watch every episode of The Simpsons.
And, I mean, and get all their history as well because The Simpsons had already predicted it.
There was, yeah, exactly. You're right. There was an episode where a villain, Homer Simpson wants the Dallas Cowboys, and this James Bond villain at the end of the episode goes, I couldn't get you the Cowboys. I got you the Denver Broncos. And Homer goes, ugh, the Denver Broncos. And Marge says, I think owning the Denver Broncos is a good thing. And he says, you don't know anything about football. That came at a time where the Broncos were kind of the laughing stock of the NFL. Get them to a Super Bowl, they'll lose by double digits. They'll get blown out. They'll get crushed. The Broncos, blah. And this changed it. They became Super Bowl champions. They beat the team everybody was ready to go, dynasty. Who's going to beat the Packers and Brett Favre? No one. And that was it. They prevented the Green Bay dynasty. They prevented the Packers and Brett Favre from establishing themselves with back-to-back Super Bowls, something we don't always see, but we then saw it a year later when they beat the Atlanta Falcons. So January 25th, it's got a number of pretty good Super Bowls on its resume and some quirky historical, but also really significant. Seeing the Giants win their first one, the Broncos win their first one, and I remember 81 and sort of the Oakland Raiders and Philadelphia Eagles competing at the Superdome in New Orleans. All right, that'll do it for us. The Lombardi Line's coming up next. We'll be back tomorrow for Throwback Thursday and more previewing of the championship games this weekend in the NFL. Again, glad you'd be with us. Tony D, Ron Culver, and this is Wake Up Call.